Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the changing political winds 1 year after the surprise upset election of Donald Trump, who, in spite of record low approval numbers, remains popular with Republicans, 92% of whom say in a recent poll by Politico that they would vote for him again. Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is the co-founder of Mother Jones magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation, joins us to analyze the reasons behind the recent victories for Democrats in Virginia and New Jersey and how this new momentum can be built on. He argues that it is all about turnout, something which has dogged Democrats in midterm elections. And since already a substantial majority of Americans see Trump as a disastrous and destructive president, a coalition of pragmatic and populist Democrats, together with rueful independents and disillusioned Republicans, could sweep enough Republicans out of the House and Senate in 2018 to take back control of the legislative branch and then, in 2020, the executive branch. Then we'll continue the analysis of the beginning of the end of Trump and Trumpism, and the revival of a political opposition energized by recent electoral victories, and speak with Rui Teixeira, the author of The Emerging Democratic Majority, whose latest book is The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think. He joins us to discuss the reasons why the American left should be optimistic in spite of the unlimited dark money behind the Republicans and their cynical use of voter suppression and gerrymandering. And while he cautions the left not to fall into Hillary Clinton's trap of labeling Trump voters as deplorables, he argues there is a way for the party of working Americans to win back the white working class and for progressives to stop being defensive and pessimistic and to be proud of their achievements and determined to make America better again. And joining us now is Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is the former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Richard. And last week, there was a shot in the arm for the Democrats with victories in the governor's race in both Virginia and New Jersey, and also in Washington State, establishing what's called the Blue Wall along the West Coast. But
right.
It doesn't, I don't think, necessarily translate in terms of some of the more red states where New Jersey being a Democratic state, that's not a surprise. And Virginia did vote for Hillary Clinton and is largely a purple, if not a blue state. What's your sense, though? The reverse scenario would have been absolutely devastating for Democrats. But are they a little over-enthusiastic, or do you think they have just cause to feel optimistic?
It was a question of turnout. I mean, I think that the lesson from 2016 was one about turnout, and in particular getting minorities and young people out to the polls. And the evidence so far seems to be that it did, particularly in northern Virginia, where the number of voters was up by 250,000 over 2013. So really a significant jump. You know, the southwestern part of the state is impoverished compared to northern and eastern Virginia. It has not had job gains since the 2008 Great Recession, and it voted overwhelmingly for the Republican candidate, Ed Gillespie. But the sheer numbers in eastern and northern Virginia and the fact that that voters turned out, both minority voters and white voters, on the Democratic line really made the difference. And I think that this is a lesson that a lot of people who do ground game politics have been arguing for quite some time, that in fact, a focus of the Clinton campaign on a highly technical and highly technological voter turnout system actually hurt them in a number of ways. And, you know, this time, while the system was by no means perfect and at times seemed still overly technological, you know, people were willing to turn out. I did voter turnout calls on the weekend before the election and was just surprised at the number of people who were overtly enthusiastic, who told me that they had already been around passing out flyers or going to their neighborhoods and promising to take people to the polls. So, you know, the question is, can that enthusiasm be generated in a lot of other races across the country over the next 4 to 8 years? Because it's going to take quite a bit of work. And, you know, what will the Republican response be? Will their voters begin to become more engaged? Because there wasn't such a big jump on the Gillespie side of the aisle as there was on the Northam side.
Well, Barack Obama once said that Democrats have almost a genetic problem of not showing up for midterms. So do you think that this 2018 midterm is going to be different?
Well, so look, again, I mean, it was raining and cold in Northern Virginia last Tuesday. And as I say, you know, voting was up by 250,000 votes, 260,000 votes. So, again, I think it's a question of can enthusiasm and fear be maintained? I mean, I think that on the fear side, you know, we have Donald Trump working for the Democratic Party. And I don't think that he was considered to actually be within serious winning distance for much of the campaign in 2016 after the convention. And, you know, I think that a fair number of voters, minority voters and young voters, just weren't enthusiastic enough about her. Some were still licking their wounds about Bernie Sanders, and you didn't get the turnout you needed in order to win the victory that you needed to win.
So is there a way, or is there work being done on sort of bringing these groups together, or is it all sort of happening spontaneously? For example, the day after Trump's election, there was a massive manifestation of women around the country and around the world showing up in huge numbers, dwarfing Trump's inauguration crowd. So,
well, not if you talk to Sean Spicer. No, I think that's wrong.
I know, and you know, by the way, it's very interesting, just as a digression here on trying to understand Trump's psychological makeup. He talks about his great Electoral College victory all the time. And he's doing, you know, last week and this week abroad in Asia, he's doing the same thing.
Right.
I think it's a sort of window into how insecure he really is for all of his bluster.
Right.
He keeps having to remind himself. I think a part of him knows that he's screwing up mightily and he's a complete catastrophe.
Right, and I think that being exposed as a complete catastrophe is exactly the kind of paranoid fear that people like this live with. And I think that you're absolutely right in pointing it out, because I think that, you know, he's, as the Texans say, all hat and no cattle. So
back to the idea of, I mean, if you could, I guess a very imprecise breakdown of the electorate would be that you've got pragmatists on the Democratic side and the Republican side, and populists on the Democratic and the Republican side. So
In
terms of the Democratic challenge, can they bring the populists and the pragmatists together, or even peel off some of the disaffected Republicans? Could you form that kind of coalition?
Well, so I think, again, it depends on 2018. I think in 2020, if Trump is on the ticket, that Trump is going to drive that coalition. That, you know, I think that non-white college graduates, non-white, non-college graduates in Virginia showed up at overwhelming levels. I mean, the minority vote was like 80% for Northam, and it was just under 50% among whites. So there's a huge difference right now, and the big difference is that if you can turn out those minority votes and then hold on to, you know, 40% of the white vote, you're going to win a lot of elections. And so that's the key. But, you know, what we know, even in the Northam election, was that Northam didn't win a majority of white men or of white women. So,
well, it's pretty clear that Trump is a catastrophe. And the main argument, at least I would think, that could be made against him, and a billionaire hedge fund guy out here in California is running ads, Tom Steyer, questioning his mental stability and whether he should have access to the nuclear button. I do believe that is the strongest issue. I wish there was a way. I know a group of psychiatrists at Yale the duty to warn, they call themselves, trying to run with that ball. I think it's a very, very important thing. And it leads me to the main question here when you mentioned if Trump's on the ticket in 2020. Would it be better in a way for him to be on the ticket? And if the Democrats take the House and even the Senate in 2018 and they move to impeachment, which I think is a reasonably good bet, would you be better off with Trump than Pence? My sense is that the nuclear button overrides everything because I think it's a clear and present danger. But I do believe that Pence would be more effective as a Republican.
So two things. I mean, one is I haven't looked at polling data about the general fear of nuclear war. I know that there was a spike of concern when there was saber rattling with the North Koreans, but I think that was situational and not likely to be long-lasting in terms of people's consciousness. It's hard for me to say exactly what's going to drive the margin of voters over to the Democratic side in this coming campaign. Again, you know, I keep being surprised that white men and white women continue to vote for the conservatives. And while I understand that that's heavily concentrated in one region of the country, it's still quite striking. I mean, I was looking at the returns by race for New England versus the Deep South, and what struck me in the 2016 race was that white males in Vermont and Massachusetts voted for Clinton 2-1, but white males in Mississippi voted less than 1 in 10. Actually, 1 in 11 white males went for Clinton in Mississippi. And it's that stark contrast between not simply gender and race, but race, gender, region, that I think that we have to take account of, because I think, one, it helps mobilize minority votes. Two, it also helps bring over some loose number of independent white males who would be more open to voting for the Democratic candidate. You know, the psychiatric claim, I think, is important, but I think that there are ways that he could stonewall that or border wall that in terms of his own base and try and turn the accusation into a counter-accusation of, you know, coastal elitism that might work to run up the vote in California and New York and Massachusetts, but not do the job that we need in the purple state. I just don't know how Appalachian, Pennsylvania voters get swung back into the Democratic column by the psychiatric argument. That's the problem. You know, and I thought what was so interesting about his announcement with Xi in China, that a Chinese energy company, basically a coal company, was prepared to invest $250 billion in West Virginia, perversely signals locking West Virginia into the Republican column. So I think that those kinds of promises, however chimerical, of big-time investment are going to be super important in the swing state.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and is a former managing editor of Ramparts and was co-founder of Mother Jones magazine. In a recent Politico poll finds that 82% of respondents who voted for Trump in the 2016 presidential race say they would support him again. And obviously, for the Democrats, it's not a healthy strategy to depend entirely upon impeachment. You know, the old,
right.
They've always
right.
run on that platform, we're better than the other
right.
guy, or the other guy's a right. disaster. We may not be that great, but the other guy's a disaster.
Right.
I don't think we can afford to rely on that. But I'm concerned about the Russia investigation, the extent to which Mike Pompeo, who's already shown fealty to Trump in a political sense and not and abandon his own
sure.
rank and file at the CIA by talking to a conspiracy theorist that Trump told him to talk to. That
right.
has an absurd theory that a U.S. intelligence insider hacked the DNC, not the Russians.
Right.
That's a really, that's a scary prospect, that because the head of the CIA could either withhold evidence from Mueller or Stonewall. Sure. But when you mentioned the possibility of nuclear war with North Korea, which is, certainly seems to be abating a little bit, on the other hand, the possibility of a war in the Gulf between Saudi Arabia and Iran is increasing quite dangerously with this impetuous young boy king who's very close to Jared Kushner. And and my understanding,
another boy king.
Exactly. You've got spoiled brats.
Two boy kings.
Yeah, you got these spoiled brats loose on the world stage. But what I understand is what's really going on with Jared Kushner and his father-in-law Trump is the extent to which they're using the U.S. presidency and executive branch as a way to further their business interests. And and we already know that Ivanka got $100 million for her foundation from MBS. And apparently MBS and Jared, a week or so ago, plotted until 4 in the morning this arrest of all these princes under the rubric of stamping out corruption, which is exactly how the House of Saud operates.
Stamping out their corruption, not our corruption.
Exactly. Right. But this is where I think there may be a shoe may drop, at least one hopes, that Jared could well end up with some of this confiscated wealth to get out from under his appalling vanity investment in 666 Fifth Avenue that's been underwater ever since. So,
I think you're onto something there. And I mean, I've been watching this U.S.-Saudi connection. You ought to have Craig Unger on, who's written well on the House of Saud.
Right, I did. When he had his book out, I talked to him.
He might be good to get him back now to talk about this young prince and what it implies. I mean, I keep thinking back to the Reagan days and how that link was forged with Saudi Arabia as part of the whole Iran-Contra arrangement, and even earlier to 1974 when the deal that Nixon and Kissinger cut with Saudi Arabia over the price hikes of oil was that the Saudis in turn, as with the Iranians, would agree to a channel for an extended period of time their profits, their petrodollar profits, through the New York banking system, which they did. So there's a strong connection between a series of Republican presidents, Nixon and the first price hike along with Kissinger, then Reagan and all of the shenanigans that were going on where the Saudis were helping finance the executive branch's foreign policy after the legislative branch had constitutionally denied them funds to do so. And then, of course, the rewards that poured out of Kuwaiti coffers after the Gulf War to the Bush family and related, and now this, you know, it seems. I think I'm seeing a pattern, and I don't know about you.
Right. Well, I think Alawid bin Talal, the billionaire that's just lost everything to the boy king, he's got some very valuable property in Manhattan. So it's just too coincidental. And of course, we know that Jared and his family, the Kushners, are very close to Netanyahu, and He's operating as a go-between, I think, between MBS and Netanyahu. Something's definitely brewing there. I think there may be...
Oh, I think something very big, and I can't put my fingers on it exactly. Yeah. But yes, no, absolutely. Yeah. I can't tell whether they think that what they're doing is providing some kind of counter-move to Iranian expansion after Iranian successes in Iraq and Syria against ISIS. That may be one version of the story, or one piece of the story. I think your other about sort of mutual assured corruption is another part of it between the Kushners and Kushners, Netanyahu, and the Saudis. And then the third part is, you know, part of the deal that Trump signed with the Saudis on his visit was this $100 billion arms contract. And of course, the American arms industry, the Middle East, has historically proved to be just a gold mine of sales opportunities, even when some of the most advanced technology is never used.
Well, I bring it up in the context of what will save us from this nightmare of Trump.
Right.
Because every day you read the paper and it's the sort of daily dose of doom, particularly the kind of people that are the EPA, for example, that are just, it's horrible what they're doing or what they're not doing. And you mentioned this idea of investing in coal, and then as an insult to the Paris Agreement or rubbing salt in the wound, they send over a bunch of coal executives to tout coal with the climate change conference. So
Well, and again, I mean, I think this is what the U.S. is looking for, and this is the game that China is willing to play right now in this slow, rolling transition of hegemonic leadership away from the West and toward the East, which is we want to demonstrate to the world that our two governments can strike bilateral condominium deals no matter what we promise to agree to or what we find that the rest of the world wants to do about any given subject. I mean, essentially, this is kind of the Anglo-American alliance of olden days being reconstructed as a kind of Sino-American alliance, if you will, but definitely with some sense of mutually shared power between the two countries.
Right, but it's a deal. And most of the deals that you mentioned were about consolidating and cooperating into the future. This is a peculiar one because the Chinese are moving into the 21st century, all electric vehicles, et cetera, huge investments.
Right, they're moving past carbon, and last week they signaled that they were ready to get, you know, waist deep or neck deep in carbon production in West Virginia, ostensibly,
right,
because it's financially profitable, but more, it looks like, because they want to placate Trump and make him look like a winner from his Chinese trip. Now, of course, commentators are already saying, look, this was at most, as best we can tell, a memorandum of understanding, not a contract, and no real dollars have yet hit the table, and it's going to be a long time before we know whether this $250 billion number was just pulled out of a hat in some ways. But you know,
right. Well, of course,
we can't know that in advance. This is such an historically typical game that large powers play, whether it's at G7 meetings or in these bilateral kinds of meetings where they make big promises. I have no idea, for example, of this Boeing contract, how many of these include, you know, already contracted Boeing sales to China. You know, No one seems to quite have a handle.
Well, let's face
all
it.
All new equipment or...
Sure. Well, let's face it, Richard, the Trump administration, or Trump himself, the Trump White House, is government by stunt. He's a reality television star.
Sure.
He's got the ultimate reality TV job as, you know, survivor in the Oval Office. It's an amazing for a reality television guy to have that kind of situation. And he knows how to keep billboarding his upcoming episode. And, of course, it never delivers the
promise. Well, right. And I mean, I think he's right. And I think he thinks of his share of the voters as his slice of the Nielsen ratings. And what he's going to do for the next few years is defend his slice of the Nielsen ratings against all comers and all odds, even though it's not a majority slice. It is a significant sort of veto force, even if it isn't a majority. And it means that others, such as the congressional Republicans and others, such as the Democrats, have to constantly be aware that 35, 36, 38% is staying with him, because that's what his reality television behavior is, you know, is doing. It's cementing that loyalty to him, so they're not going to go away.
Right, but do you think at the end of the day, Rupert Murdoch and Sinclair and these bilious billionaires that are backing him and keeping his people inside of that bubble of illusion, that everything else outside the bubble is fake news and he's the truth teller. It's a powerful totalitarian media machine that they've created.
Sure.
I mean, you know, they've obviously learned from Putin that you can...
Well, and you know, also, listen, I mean, America is a regionally and culturally divided country. I mean, the White South functioned for 250, even 300 years around an idea that slavery was a normal system of human relationships. And, you know, their ability to hold out against ideas that may be normative in other parts of the country is, you know, well known, well demonstrated.
Well, just in closing then, Richard, the question would be then, can the Trump media machine run by Murdoch, who talks to him every day, maintain the illusion of governance when there isn't any, and keep the 80% on side? You still, at the end of the day, you still got a majority opposing him, at least 65% of the country. So it's hard to believe you can't organize a 65% majority. And then you've got this wild card in foreign policy, which has brought down so many presidents and changed our history. It's almost as if the America does not control its own political destiny. If you think about Sirhan Sirhan being a Palestinian, and then Osama bin Laden, and then the Ayatollah Khomeini brought down Jimmy Carter, and you could go through a whole list, and George Bush on the crashing on the shoulders of Osama bin Laden, and so forth. So we talked about Jared and the chicanery going on with MBS. So just in the last minute or so, tell me what you think is likely to be a combination of what will bring Trump down and end this nightmare.
Yeah, so first, I mean, I don't pay attention to that roughly two-thirds of Americans who say that they're opposed to Trump's policies or, you know, disturbed by Trump's personality, because that's two-thirds of the population, not two-thirds of the voting base. And, you know, what you have to do is consider that there are also Republicans and independents who will say that, but who will also then move to the Republican column once they step inside the voting booth, which is what was happening all last year that I think made it difficult for pollsters to get at who was going to vote for Trump. I mean, the evidence after the exit polls at the election is that even though Trump lost a majority of Republican votes in the Republican primaries, he was able to win back 80% of the Republican base in the general because they couldn't abide the idea of Hillary Clinton. So I don't think that he's near finished if what we're talking about is simply a question of electoral opinion. My belief is that this is a ground war of an old-fashioned kind that's going to be won on turnout. Last Sunday was my birthday, and so my wife and I actually invited 35 friends over, and we had cake and champagne, and then we spent 2 hours making turnout calls to Virginia and got a good sampling of Virginia voters' attitudes, at least Virginia Democrats' voters' attitudes, from it. And I think that the more Democrats focus on the practicality, progressives focus on the practicality of overwhelming Trump and the Republicans through sheer numbers at the polls, the likely we are to end this, you know, tragicomic era in American history. Relying on polling dissent among the entire population isn't the way to do it. And while you're absolutely right about sort of these lightning strikes from nowhere, whether it's Sirhan or Lee Harvey Oswald or any of a dozen different things that could bring Trump down, again, I would do as much planning to defeat him as I possibly could and then trust that something will appear, but without being able to know what it is.
Well, Richard Parker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, it's always good to talk with you, Ian. Have a good Sunday.
You too. Thank you so much. And again, I'll be speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's a former managing editor of Ramparts and the co-founder of Mother Jones Magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. We're going to take a brief station break and be back continuing the analysis of the beginning of the end of Trump and Trumpism. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Rui Teixeira, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and an author or co-author of several books on American politics, including The Emerging Democratic Majority, written with John Judas. His latest book is The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think. And he is the co-author of a new report at the Center for American Progress, Voter Trends in 2016, A Final Examination. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rui Teixeira.
Glad to be here.
And just to touch on your report, of course, last week marked the one-year anniversary of Donald Trump's victory. And ever since then, I think Democrats have been despondent, if not alarmed, at what's happened, both in terms of domestic and foreign policy. There was a bit of a change in that tide of depression last Tuesday with the good Democratic results in both Virginia and in New Jersey, as well as the completion of what they call the blue wall here on the West Coast with Democratic victories in the state of Washington. So are you a little more optimistic this week than you were last week?
Well, I would say that my long-range optimism hasn't changed, because that's really what the book that I recently put out is about. That, you know, broadly speaking, if you look over the course of, you know, a number of decades, if you look over the likely course of the 21st century, I do think the values and priorities of the left are likely to triumph, and we're likely to see a more prosperous and more just world. I do think that's sort of the general trend over time, even if bad things happen, you know, two steps forward, one step back. Well, one step back was certainly the election of Donald Trump, from which I think some people took the lesson. And of course, looking at the events in, you know, some events in Europe, some bad outcomes there, people are sort of worried about that as well. It's like this rising tide of reactionary, even quasi-racist populism was going to overwhelm the Western world in general, and the United States in particular, and woe is us. Well, I didn't think that the election of Donald Trump was anything but bad, but I always thought that the reaction to it was a little bit overstated. I did think that populism was likely to have a relatively short shelf life, that voters would get tired of it, that the rise in constituencies that these movements ignore were just going to get bigger. And since they were unlikely to be able to deliver for the very voters who put them in office, there would likely be a backlash there as well. And it just didn't add up to a winning formula over time. So I'm more optimistic, I guess, in the sense that of the timing. I mean, I wasn't sure how long this sort of backlash might take to develop, and how long it might take for voters to lose interest in what Trump had to offer, and or for his unpopularity to really start hurting the Republican Party. But I think that's already happened. You know, and it's too early to say, oh, well, you know, the Democrats will certainly do great in 2018, 2020, and beyond. But there's no gainsaying the fact that this is a very bad result for the Republicans. And it does not appear like Donald Trump has repealed the laws of politics and or can defy political gravity.
Well, but let's go back to the 1970s. I want to get a sense from you what happened to the liberal majority in this country, because back then, and for some decades prior to that, the Democrats had a massive majority in the Senate and the House, and they also had a real liberal majority on the Supreme Court, with real liberals like Thurgood Marshall and William O. Douglas, as opposed to the idea that, you know, we have arch conservatives now and sort of moderate Democrats or centrist Democrats. So the country has moved so rapidly and radically to the right, particularly in the judiciary. Did the liberals in this country not, what happened to them? Did they lose heart? They had it made, and they had so much political power, and it's just been dissipating over the decades. And I wonder whether there's a psychological component as well as a political one.
I guess I wouldn't say it's you know, terribly psychological. I think the underlying reason why the left in the U.S. has done relatively poorly in the last number of decades, and I think the same thing is true of Europe, is that fundamentally the left, and this is a point I try to make in my book, it actually tends to be better off when capitalism is performing well and people's living standards are rising with some degree of certainty, where people see their lives getting better and they have hope for the future. In a situation in which growth slows down and inequality rises, reaction inevitably sets in. And I think that's what we've seen across the Western world, including in the United States. So the Republicans, for example, looking specifically at the United States, were able to take advantage of this shift in the political economy to make their case to what formerly was a Democratic-leaning constituency, white working class or non-college educated voters. And if you look at the data, it's very clear that that is a constituency upon which they built their improved fortunes over time. Now, that is a rapidly diminishing constituency, but it's still quite large in the United States, and certainly large enough to help the Republicans do well politically, particularly when you take into account other factors, gerrymandering, the geographic concentration of Democratic voters in more urbanized areas, the small state bias in the Senate. And there's a number of things that actually, particular to the U.S. political system, that help the Republicans sort of overperform their actual support among the public as a whole. So I think, you know, that happened in terms of, you know, the change in political economy and how the Republicans reacted to it. And I think if you want to fault the Democrats, and I think there's certainly fault to go around, I think they failed to understand or to take seriously enough that these changes were taking place, that capitalism, in fact, was evolving in a way that was against the interests of most people and certainly against the interests of the left, and that they had to have a sort of more robust approach to improving it. The old Keynesian welfare state, as productive as it was in many ways, clearly needed an update, and they had to kind of get on the case. Instead, I think they tended to tack a bit to the right and accept the prevailing economic arrangements. There was a famous third way in the 90s, which, you know, I think it's fair to say was characterized by sort of an acceptance of how capitalism and globalization were evolving and sort of, well, let's just accept that's going on and let's try to redistribute the benefits from that a little bit better than they've been taking. But we don't want to interfere with the market. We don't want to interfere with how capitalism has been evolving. So I think, you know, in very broad brush, I think that's what's happened to the left, is they've sort of lost the plot and now they're sort of regaining it. I mean, I think it's important to point out that despite this period of relatively good fortunes for the right and relatively poor fortunes for the left, it's not as if nothing good has happened in this time period. It's not as if the right has succeeded in blowing up the welfare state, either here or in Europe. I mean, by and large, the state is about as big as it's ever been. They prevented it from going farther. They prevented improvements from being made in the way government functions and the services it delivers for people, but by no means have they been able to eliminate them. And look what happened under Obama. Despite the poor economic circumstances, they actually made quite a lot of advances in terms of improving the American government and improving the kind of services it could provide to constituents. And of course, now that they've been made, they're extremely hard to get rid of. I mean, this is really the root of the Republican crash and burn on the Obamacare repeal and replace. Because people don't like it once they have benefits. Right. Once they get something that they feel improves their lives, they don't want it taken away.
Surprise,
same
surprise.
Same thing has been true in Europe as well.
Right. Well, that is, of course, the argument for social democracy. And frankly, I'm always amazed that we don't make a better argument on the left for social democracy as they have in Europe. And it's also puzzling, of course, that after the Marshall Plan gave Western Europe social democracy, but not necessarily here at home. And the argument shouldn't be about big government versus smaller government. It should be about better government. And the idea that you pay your taxes and get your government services has somehow been lost or been beaten down and extinguished by this kind of Republican canard that started under Reagan.
I certainly agree with that. And I think that one thing that's happening now at the left, again, both here and in other places, is I think they're realizing that giving in to that kind of, you know, view of government is not a good idea. That you may think you need to tack a bit to the right in that stuff to reach so-called swing voters, but in reality, it's not really a program that benefits the left over the long haul, and certainly doesn't benefit the countries in which the left tries to improve things. By and large, if you want people to support government, get government to function better, and try to have a more healthy economic growth model than the ones we've had. And that's really the key. But simply giving in to the rhetoric about how government, you know, is intrinsically wasteful, intrinsically bad for people, it's just too big, we need to cut it down. I mean, this was kind of a bad bet on the part of certain parts of the left, that sort of by trying to mollify those sentiments, they could sneak in the back door, and I don't think it worked.
And again, I'm speaking with Rui Teixeira, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author or co-author of several books on American politics, including The Emerging Democratic Majority, written with John Judas. His latest book is The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think. And he is the co-author of a new report at the Center for American Progress, Voter Trends in 2016, A Final Examination. Now, earlier when you were talking about the challenges or what the reasons why the right has been more successful, clearly there are more, the Democrats have a natural majority, it would seem. There are more average folks than there are rich folks, but they do not seem to be able to inspire all of their people to come out to vote, whereas the right seem to be able to get every last Republican out to vote. But they do have some structural changes that seems to be a way to maintain a Republican majority, even though they are in effect a minority, and that is gerrymandering, as you mentioned, and the concentration of blue voters in urban areas. And over time, I understand that there's some serious challenges here. We could end up in a couple of decades with 60% of the U.S. Senate elected by 40% of the country in terms of red states, and we could end up with the last election where the Democrat got 3 million more votes than the Republican, yet he became president. That could become the new normal with the way the Electoral College is structured, even though it's at times favored Democrats, but lately favored Republicans. So let's talk about those structural problems. And of course, adding to that, you have the fact that Citizens United has given unlimited plutocratic money to the Republican Party that's both unlimited and invisible. So let's start with those structural problems. How do you undo gerrymandering, and can you undo the Electoral College?
Right. Well, I think there are several things that mitigate this problem, even though there's no question it's a problem and no question that it's been leveraged extremely effectively by the Republicans. To begin with, gerrymandering can be un-gerrymandered, so, to some extent. So obviously it becomes important that Democrats have more of a voice and role in the redistricting process, and or you change the redistricting process so it's essentially more neutral. I think these things are doable, and I think the Democrats are taking them much more seriously than they have. And if you look at the sort of the election cycles that are coming up, the Democrats might actually have a good chance to do well in the elections that will determine who controls redistricting. So that's one thing. Another thing is these districts are not stable. In other words, demographically, even when you gerrymander districts and you sort of try to create more 55-45 districts for your party and a bunch of 80-20 districts for the other guys so they waste their votes, those 55-45 districts, just to pick a number, are not stable. The constituencies in those, the demographic constituencies, the mix of them change over time, and even their preferences and inclinations may change over time. So it's not a guarantee that you're going to be able to continue to control those districts simply by virtue of having drawn the lines 10 years ago. But a good example is what happened in the Virginia legislative elections on Tuesday, which is that, that's a heavily gerrymandered state, especially in terms of the state legislature. And the Democrats, it looked like people thought the Democrats could never, take back the assembly, House of Delegates, for decades. And yet they've either done it or come very close. They picked up somewhere between 14 and 16 seats, making it about an even split from a 66-34 Republican majority. So these things can be overcome. And this actually relates to a third point about, how you deal with these structural obstacles. The way you deal with structural obstacles is, in broad brush, you try to A, change them, and B, you try to work as hard as you can within those constraints to maximize your political impact. So I think it's fair to say the Democrats have kind of fallen down on the job in terms of competing in a lot of rural and small town America and some parts of ex-urban metro America as well. So the idea that you can compete without actually putting, sort of shoes on the ground there and without working hard in these areas, without trying to take advantage of whatever leverage you have is probably incorrect. I think Democrats are now realizing that they really have to compete as close as possible to everywhere. They need a 50-state strategy. They need a 3,143-county strategy. Howard Dean had this right, those many years ago, when he was trying to push that idea within the Democratic Party. I think that idea has reawakened, and I think is being taken quite seriously. Now, none of this to say that, you know, we're not still going to see structural advantages for the Republicans going forward. There's a certain amount of this that can't be gotten rid of, or at least gotten rid of anytime soon. But I think the Democrats are realizing that they have to work it a bit harder and both try to change the playing field and play better on the playing field itself. So, yeah, I don't see where the Republicans have any kind of an electoral lock at this point. It strikes me as being very, very fragile, that Electoral College victory in 2016, unless you believe that suddenly these are all red states. I mean, all the states that the Republicans flipped in 2016, they're all lost, you know. So, Iowa, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, I don't believe that. I think they're still quite competitive.
Well, but in terms of the Electoral College, of course, there is this movement, the National Popular Vote, which is a simple mechanism to do an end run around a constitutional amendment, which is a heavy lift. But it's mostly gotten Democratic votes to sign on. Well, Rui Teixeira, let's take a brief station break and we'll be back and continue the conversation. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with Rui Teixeira, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author and co-author of several books on American politics, including Emerging Democratic Majority, written with John Judas. His latest book is The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Would Be Better Than You Think. And he is the co-author of a new report at the Center for American Progress, Voter Trends in 2016, A Final Examination. So a year on from Donald Trump's election, my sense, Rui, is that even though Trump himself may not last very long, and if the Democrats take back the House in 2018, which more and more likely that they certainly have an improving chance of doing that, there may be an impeachment. But on the other hand, my sense is that that's not a particularly healthy thing to rely on, the idea that it's, you know, we're better than the other guy, which unfortunately has been too often the mantra. It might be better to work on a new, you know, narrative and platform and policies as opposed to hoping that this disastrous aberration will somehow self-destruct. What's your take on that?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that there's only so much leverage you can gain from simply opposing the other side. It's very useful to help you get into office, or certainly part of what you need to use to get into office. But in the end, it comes down to what do you really stand for, and what are you going to do once you're actually in office? How are you really going to change people's lives? How are you going to make the economy function better, and so on? That's really the only way to stop populism in the medium to long run, is you make the country function better and deliver benefits for more people, and, you know, help communities that are being left behind be not so left behind. People need hope for the future, and it's not enough just to oppose the other side. You have to actually have something going on your side, and you have to try to implement that as effectively as you can once you do gain office, for however long you are in office. So I think, you know, I have written many, many things over the years, and going back to that book, The Emerging Democratic Majority, that you mentioned, that discussed, among other things, that the Democrats were benefited to some extent by the way the country was evolving demographically. But I always tried to emphasize that you ultimately you have to deliver for people. You have to govern better. You have to do a better job of sort of cutting into the Republican margins among groups like white non-college voters who do clearly feel left behind, and there are some reasons why they feel that. So, I think that the road ahead is actually fairly clear in terms of what the Democrats need to do, and they should not let themselves be diverted by, sort of picking up in the latest outrage that Donald Trump puts into play. I think it's sort of fool's gold. I mean, you benefit from it in the short run, and certainly it'd be crazy not to try to take advantage of, but it's not the real thing. It's not the prize. It's not what you should be aiming for.
But I think one of the things that Donald Trump did successfully, and I think it was largely by default, because it's kind of the opposite of Hillary Clinton's remarks about the basket full of deplorables. What I hear from conservatives and Trump voters, and particularly some who voted for Obama but then voted for Trump, is that somehow, and we know that the idea of the elites is a complete canard, because the people who fund the Republican Party, like the Koch brothers and the Mercers, are truly the elites. We've just learned from the Paradise Papers how much money they've salted away overseas, and which means that we have to pay more taxes because they don't pay taxes. So they are the real elites, and clearly the Koch brothers are the only beneficiary so far of the Republican successes, if that's the right word, in the Congress. Almost everything that's been passed, not that anything much has been passed, but a lot of changes at the regulatory level have all benefited the Koch brothers. So it's a pay-for-play system for sure, and that the working-class people who voted for Trump are going to get hosed. But you can't tell them that you bought a lemon. People don't like to be told that they made a bad investment. But it would seem to me it wouldn't be very difficult to start being sort of more generous and kinder towards people that voted for Trump. And I don't know how you make that argument across this barrier or this divide, this silo of information where you've got the Fox bubble that's telling everybody that Trump is great and that the mainstream media is all about fake news. And then everything in the real media is not believed. It doesn't seem to have the impact it should have. So we do have, alternative universes there. But just on the at a purely sort of, I don't know whether it's psychological, but certainly on a personal level, it would seem to me that a little humility might be helpful.
Yeah, I certainly couldn't agree with that more. It's not just that people, you don't want to just hammer people for making a dumb investment, which is sort of how it comes across at times when people talk about folks who voted for Trump. But what's worse, I think, is that it's very comforting, it seems to me, for people on the left and liberals, or they find it comforting to basically describe these people as all racists and beyond the pale, and they're just reactionaries, troglodytes, the polite people shouldn't have anything to do with them. That is really toxic. I mean, when people feel that kind of attitude emanating from Democrats, the left, from liberals, it turns them off completely, and you can't possibly reach them, even if they have things they're dissatisfied about with Trump or with the Republican Party, and you can't get them to listen to maybe your ideas about how you can make their communities better. So, yeah, I think it starts with that. You have the respect that people have complicated motives for what they do. There are indeed some hardcore racists, but that's just not the whole story, and it's certainly not all the people who voted for Trump. So, yeah, I think the left needs to take a good hard look at its attitude about some of these things and try to, as you say, being more, sort of open-armed and open-hearted about people who disagree with them.
And in terms of Trump's lasting legacy, which I think will be pretty thin, and mostly it'll be a trail of wreckage, both domestically and in terms of foreign policy. But the one thing I think that he has achieved is he's changed the political dialogue, in as much as if you watch him at his rallies, he does engage the audience. Now, it's true he's a huckster and it's all a con, but he does engage them, even if he's talking incredibly in very simplistic terms. You can see the people like being talked to in that way because he's not a politician. And I don't know too many politicians who aren't politicians. Maybe Al Franken from Minnesota, he talks like a real person. But, you know, I was watching Chuck Schumer just after the terrorist incident in New York, where he was attacked savagely by Trump, and completely erroneously. But rather than, you know, nail Trump for his lies, he sort of said in this cute way, "It's time, Mr. President, to stop tweeting and start governing." And he'd, in that rhythm of politicians. And yeah, I guarantee you, that is not working anymore. I think that's the main change that Trump has made. What's your sense of that? Do you think that can you name too many politicians who don't sound like politicians?
Well, that is tough. I mean, I guess it's more politicians who do a little bit better job sounding not like politicians rather than completely don't sound like politicians. I mean, I suppose people like Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown are a little bit better, but I think it's a matter of degree, not of kind. I do think that, though I agree with you, I think that Trump has put into play the idea that you really need to talk American in a sense. You need to talk in a way that people can relate to and find at least somewhat authentic, and that if you come off as just a pal, just an elite, that's kind of a bad look these days. All across the Western world, people are rejecting elites and think that, you know, they're just caught in their own elite bubble and they're really lost touch with most people in most communities, and it's just all bull. So I think there's a real premium at this point for politicians who can figure out how to connect directly to people and take out that politician speak filter that you're alluding to. Easier said than done, I might add, but I do think there's a premium there.
Well, given that our audience are mostly leftists, give us your final invocation for why you're an optimist and why you believe in the optimistic leftists being that the 21st century will be better than you think.
Well, I'll just give you two simple reasons. The first is, I think that if you look over the history of the 20th century and even the early 21st century, what's striking about the world is that it's gotten to be a much better place. I mean, if you look at all the indicators of health, life expectancy, food, nutrition, you know, the amount of services are available to people, education levels, how well people live, living standards. I mean, if you look in over fairly long periods of time, it's clear we live in a richer, more prosperous, a more just, more democratic, more tolerant world than we ever have before. So I think that's cause for optimism. Now, that doesn't mean everything that's happened is great. It just means that on net, over time, we're actually making significant progress. And the second thing I'd say, which I think is very important, is I think people are coming around to the idea when they look at the economy that the animal, so-called animal spirits of capitalists and investors are very important. They're really affected by how they feel what they feel their economic opportunities are, and if they don't feel like investing, if they're not feeling it, they don't have those spirits, they're not going to do it, and that contributes to economic stagnation and sometimes outright recession and depression. So if we believe that capitalists are affected by these animal spirits, well, why not the left as well? You know, if the animal spirits of the left are essentially lacking, people are just pessimistic. They think no matter how hard we try, we can't stop global warming. Everything's been a crock of since 1970. You know, I think that's really has a material effect in the ability of the left to unleash its energies. Conversely, if people have a optimistic, forward-looking, hey, we're actually making progress, we can actually get things done, these are solvable problems, let's go out and do it, I think those animal spirits can be leveraged, you know, for a much more successful left that makes progress a lot faster than perhaps we have in the past. So that's what I'd say. Get those animal spirits going.
Well, Rui Teixeira, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure, my pleasure.
And again, I mean, speaking with Rui Teixeira, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author or co-author of several books on American politics, including The Emerging Democratic Majority, written with John Judas. His latest book is The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think. And he is the co-author of a new report at the Center for American Progress, Voter Trends in 2016, A Final Examination. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.